Hey guys, it's Candace.
And it's Elena.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime. Hey guys, before I forget, because I do things like that, we told you guys about our merch. We'll be closing the merch shop August 30th. Okay.
Yeah, so don't snooze and lose.
Right. Just picture it. The year is 2033, okay? 10 years from now. And you see somebody walking around with a vintage Cousins on Crime first edition t-shirt. And you're like, whoa.
Where do I get one of those?
Yeah. And the thing is, you can't. You can't get one of those anymore because it's first edition. You know what I'm saying? So you don't want to be that guy.
No, absolutely not.
No, you just don't want to be that guy. So get it while you can. We also have like stickers and totes, my goats. Anyway, yeah, support our show if you love us. And if you don't love us, why are you listening right now? Is my question. Anyway, okay. I wish I had an ice breaking question for you, Lena, right now.
I don't.
No.
I've got one.
Go ahead.
You what? Oh, you said go ahead. Do you ever put flavor packets in your water?
I do liquid IV sometimes.
Yeah. Because that's like the best way for me to get my water intake.
Uh-huh.
And you can get the water flavor packets at, you know, wherever, Walmart, Kroger, your favorite grocery store. But I don't know if this one's at every single one of them. So Sonic has the cherry limeade packets and the ocean water packets.
What?
And I've been really loving those. Like I'm
Sonic right now, Drive-In?
Well, no, I'm sorry.
They're sold in stores?
You don't get them at Sonic. You can get them at Walmart. Okay. It's the
You can get
box.
Them in the store, but they're Sonic brand.
Sonic brand.
Wow.
And I'm drinking the ocean water flavor packet.
Does it taste like ocean water?
It does. Like a dream, actually.
Wow.
Like,
I'm going to have to check that out. I don't know if we'll have it here in South Carolina because we're not that cool, but I'll have to check next time.
Well, if you look and don't, I will mail you some.
Okay. I am excited to try that. I get the Liquid IV Pina Colada.
Okay.
And so when I drink that, I pretend I'm drinking a Pina Colada.
Yeah. I can. Yeah. Yeah. So. That's refreshing.
Because I am really bad about water intake. Mm-hmm. Really bad.
Yeah. I guzzle water when I have these flavor packets. So.
That's a good idea. I'll have to try it.
Yeah, anyway.
Well, now that we're refreshed, let's get unrefreshed.
Okay.
We really should end our episodes with something like these conversations.
True.
So this case that I have for you today was recommended to us by your mama.
Yeah.
Hi, Aunt Karen. Who's not actually a Karen at all. It's a case that may have actually never been solved because of the way the investigation went. Mm. I mean, I really can't believe we're actually talking about it today. This is the story of the murder of Susan Woods. So Susan Woods was a little shy and quiet at the time of her death. She had been going through a divorce from her husband, and she was really trying to regroup at this time in her life. She was 30 years old, living alone in a rented home near downtown Stephenville, Texas, and worked at a sandpaper factory. Well, by July 28th, 1987, she had no called, no showed to work 2 days in a row.
Oh, no.
And I'm not sure if her supervisor, like, tried calling her that first day. I assume he did. But she didn't show up the second day either, and he called her dad to see if everything was all right. And as soon as her father, Joe Adkins, got that phone call, he immediately knew this wasn't like her. Something was wrong.
Right.
Like, if her boss is calling him. So without hesitation, he got in his car and drove over to her house to check on her. And when he got there, there wasn't a stir coming from the house. By now, it was dark. The lights were all off, and that was surprising, but not as surprising as finding the front door unlocked. So he entered the home, and he made his way through the darkness and into the back bedroom. And that's when he found her.
Oh, my gosh.
Susan Wood's body was found submerged in a filled bathtub right off that bedroom. This must have been horrific.
Absolutely.
To see. The water was black. Her hands were bound behind her back with what investigators later discovered was a tank top. And her head was actually under the water. Joe rushed to the living room landline and dialed the police, and then he went outside to wait for police. Do you ever wonder, like, what a family member experiences in those must-be-drawn-out minutes while they're waiting for police? Like, I can't imagine.
No.
Standing in that yard in the darkness, all you can hear are, like, crickets.
Well, just like that last, the last case I gave last week, how the person who found Adam, like, just took off on his bike. Yeah,
he just, like, fled. It's just, like, was like a, you know, everybody responds differently.
Yeah.
And his was like, I gotta get out of here. Yeah. This is a horror movie I'm in right now. And he probably thought maybe somebody was still in the house.
Yeah.
You know, and that's probably why he took off. But you've just found your daughter, your baby, in the most horrifying situation anyone could find, any person, let alone your child.
Yeah.
And there's not one thing you can do.
No.
It's just done. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And luckily, he didn't have to wait very long. And when Sergeant Donnie Hensley arrived on the scene, he saw Joe and said, Joe, what are you doing here? You see, he didn't know any identifying information of the victim.
Oh.
So when he got to her house, he didn't know whose house he was responding to. He just got the address and showed up.
Okay.
Donnie knew Joe. They had actually both frequented the municipal golf course. So he was kind of confused. And then soon Donnie understood. Joe just kept saying, they killed her. They killed my daughter. They killed her. And so he didn't press any further. He just kind of understood.
Mm.
He gave Joe a hug, and then he entered the home and found just the most horrifying scene. Donnie told Joe, you need to go home and tell the rest of your family.
Oh, like,
you need to just go home. You know, you don't want to be, like, you don't want to be here for this. Like, I can't imagine just getting in my car and driving home after finding your adult child like that.
Yeah.
You know, but of course you don't want to sit there and watch them take her out of the house and, like, have the police surrounded. I just can't even imagine. Well, inside, police noticed a struggle had clearly taken place in the back bedroom, which was attached to that bathroom I was talking about where she was found. The mattress was hanging off the bed. The covers were scattered about. there was a white electrical cord that was laying across the bed, presumably involved in the murder somehow, maybe. One of the pillowcases had makeup all over it, which was not abnormal for like a woman. Maybe she shouldn't wash her face, but as Donnie looked closer at it, he could swear he could see the imprint of a face.
Oh my Lord.
Like the mascara was placed where the eyes would be. There was like lips. And can you imagine how eerie that must have been?
Oh my gosh.
So it looked like someone had held that pillow over her face. Now, all the elements of the scene begin to paint a picture of the crime, and it's almost as if the investigators were seeing it all play out. But they needed more, of course. In the bathroom, they were able to lift some fingerprints and palm prints, actually, which weren't going to do much for them, being that it was the late 80s. They'd only be useful to them if they had someone to match them to. Because in Texas in 1987, there was no fingerprint database yet.
Okay.
And we know that DNA wasn't being used either, so they didn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
At autopsy, the medical examiner noted a red line across Susan's throat, indicating a possible strangulation, maybe from that electrical cord found on the bed. And trigger warning here, she had been raped and sodomized. She was badly decomposed because they estimated that she had been in that water for at least 2 days. So they were not able to determine manner of death. It just wasn't clear. They said could have been strangulation, could have been it could have been suffocation, and they even thought she could have drowned in the bathtub. Like, she may have actually
been alive,
been conscious, when she was placed into the bathwater. Now, Stephenville hadn't seen much in the way of murders, certainly nothing like this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just one day after Susan's body was found, Lieutenant Ken Maltby announced that he'd be taking over the case alone. Have you ever heard of that happening, Lena? Like, it's announcement, there's a murder, and then someone announces, I'm going to be investigating this case all by myself. You know?
Interesting. A little weird.
Seems a little arrogant to me.
Yeah.
And it did to Donnie Hensley and the officers that arrived on scene as well. And to this day, Donnie, who's now retired, he can't let that go. Like, he was just booted off the case right away.
Yeah.
Well, this Ken Maltby guy wasn't the hero that he thought he was.
Oh.
He did little to investigate the case, made no progress, and a couple months after Susan's death, he ended up taking over the narcotics unit. So nobody was officially taking back over the case, so Donnie did in his spare time. I don't know what Donnie was assigned to at this point in time. I just know that he was looking into this case in his free time. He wasn't permitted to do it at work.
Gotcha.
Now, he was walking into a mess, though, because there were no written reports, nothing in the way of who'd been interviewed or what they had said. Yes, Donnie had to basically start over as if it was day one.
That's maddening.
Yes. And he would have to re-interview everybody, re-canvass the area, pretty much everything that may or may not have been done already.
Wow.
Now, interviews with the few friends she had produced more details about Susan, particularly, like, in this stage of her life. I mentioned she was going through a divorce, but when her husband left, he left her high and dry, pretty much. He moved out of state. He took their car. Their only car. So she basically had to bust her tail working 6 days a week at this sandpaper factory which makes my skin feel really dry right now. And I need some lotion. But she was busting her tail 6 days a week to save up for a new one. Not like a new car, but like new to her. And because she was constantly working and only had one day off a week, it didn't leave her much time for socializing or dating. Her friends Deborah and Cindy did tell investigators about one guy, though. His name was J.C. Bowman. He lived in the neighboring town of Granbury that had given her some really gnarly hickeys a few weeks before she died. And this was of note because Susan called Deborah and was kind of shaken by the encounter. She was really upset that she would let a guy give her hickeys. She's like, I'm 30 years old. Yeah. I'm getting a divorce. And that just got out of hand. Yeah. Like, I don't know why. Side note, one time I burned my neck with a curling iron in high school and my mom thought it was a hickey. So I understand the shame that is associated with it.
Right. You burned your neck. Okay.
No, I really did. No. I really did. When Donnie spoke with JC, he seemed like a really nice guy. Mm-hmm. And he did admit to having a little fling with Susan. He said, yeah, you know, we slept together once and things ended when I gave her all those hickeys. Like, she didn't like that. So that was a little cringe for her. His prints were taken and compared to the prints found in her home. And they were not a match.
Okay.
He passed a polygraph, so Donnie moved on. There was one more person Donnie briefly entertained, and that was Cindy's boyfriend at the time, Roy Hayes. Remember, Cindy was Susan's best friend. Now, Roy helped Susan out around the house a lot, you know, just doing things her husband might have done, but he was no longer around for. At one point, she felt really worried about living there alone, so he had nailed some windows shut for her. Well, unlike JC, Roy's prints were all over the house, given that he'd been there all the time doing stuff for her. And Roy played Dungeons and Dragons, which, you know, 1980s Satanic Panic and all of that sort of made Roy look like a possible suspect because they're like, oh, he's into Dungeons and Dragons. No. He must be into like Satan-y type things.
Right.
But Donnie had soon let go of the theory about Roy too, because he also passed a polygraph and there was really nothing other than speculation, basically, that had suggested he might be involved. Donnie began reviewing the crime scene photos to refresh his memory of that night. You know, he was the first responding officer, but, you know, months had passed. So there was no apparent forced entry, which suggested that she may have let her killer into her home willingly. Something else, on the coffee table in the living room, there was an ashtray with six cigarette butts and a can of Coke. Susan was not a smoker, and according to one of her friends, she didn't even drink caffeine. Water only, according to her friends. And this finding suggests that she may have had company, right? So she may have had company. She let them in willingly. It's probably somebody she knows, right?
Right.
By now, months had passed since Susan's murder, and though Donnie didn't feel any closer to the truth, everyone in Stephenville felt like they had already solved the case.
Oh.
Her husband did it. We haven't talked much about Susan's estranged husband, Michael, yet. So, Michael Woods stood out in a town like Stephenville. He was from Indianapolis, and he had moved to El Paso, Texas, in the second grade. Now, Stephenville in those days was a very conservative town. It was a small town. Everyone went to church on Sundays, and most businesses were actually closed on a Sunday. Dairy farms were very prevalent, and it was a dry county, so you couldn't even buy alcohol, not even beer. So if you think about people looking a little different, which Michael was, you were going to stick out like a sore thumb.
Yeah.
He wore a leather jacket. He rode a motorcycle. Uh-huh. And Susan supported him financially, which, you know, in a conservative town, people are like, well, he should be taking care of her, you know?
Yeah.
So some actually called him a bum for that reason. And also because he'd lay around in the yard without a shirt on sometimes, lifting weights, sometimes chilling, just laying there. But neighbors really didn't like that. They thought this was weird behavior.
Mm-hmm.
After all, they certainly didn't see him at church. So uh-huh. he wasn't laying out in the yard praying, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, Michael was a little rough around the edges, no doubt, but he had a volatile upbringing. He grew up quite poor. His mother was hopping around from one guy to another, one place to another, and dragging him and his siblings around. So there was no stability in his life, and mm-hmm. he ended up having 7 siblings because his mother, how do you say, was sleeping around a bunch of times. And it resulted in a bunch of siblings. And, you know, you kind of have pity for young Michael, right?
Yeah.
There's no stability. That's all he knows. So,
yeah.
Well, when he was 15, his mother moved the family yet again to Virginia this time, and he took up the guitar. He really got into playing music, and he began to play on street corners and stuff.
Hmm.
I think he was just not wanting to be at home, you know?
Gotcha.
And as he puts it, being on the streets was, quote, it wasn't as rough as being at home. So he ended up in Stephenville, though, because a friend of his had offered him work. And that's where he met Susan. She was quite the opposite of Michael, and her friends were really surprised that she had gone for a guy like that. But she thought he was adorable. She didn't date in school. She was very quiet. Like I said, she was shy. And now she goes for this bad boy type.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't just her friends. Her family was not impressed either. They didn't believe he was suitable for their daughter. Michael and Susan dated for a while, then they moved to El Paso in 1980 and married. He had another job opportunity, and I think Susan felt like maybe this time he was going to take care of her.
Mm-hmm.
So she went with him, but she obviously came from a conservative family, and she was like, you've got to marry me if we're going to be, you know, living together away in another town.
Yeah.
Like, you've got to marry me. So, and you might have guessed, this job opportunity fizzled out and they went crawling back to Stephenville.
Oh.
Michael, it didn't seem to be able to ever hold down a job. He wasn't very respected because he had a really terrible attitude.
No.
And his appearance, really. He had like shoulder length, scraggly hair. He bounced around from job to job, and, you know, bosses just didn't respect him. He had no work ethic, and you know, you think about his upbringing, and the instability was normal for him. So he didn't really care to do well.
Yeah, this was his life. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, he had no motivation. He's never seen, like, someone hold down a job and that lead to great things in life. He just was like, eh, you know.
Yeah.
And Susan wanted to make him happy. That's just how she was. So she kind of leaned in to this unpredictable lifestyle. She ended up moving back to Indianapolis with him to be closer to his brother at one point. They moved other places to try and make things work, but they never settled down.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, someone would say, oh, you didn't unpack that box. And she's like, yeah, I don't think we're going to be here long.
Oh,
you know,
no.
She kind of knew that they needed to go back to Stephenville. Like, we need to go back. You know, this is, that's where my family is. That's where, that's the only thing I know. And I'm really the only one here having stability. And if we're going to make it, we, you know.
Yeah.
So they ultimately ended up back in Stephenville because, let's face it, Susan was the stability in the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, when they got back there, she's like, okay, you're going to have to cut the crap. You know, like, let's just start over. But he didn't cut the crap. He would get into fights, spats with the neighbors. And police got to know him pretty well, even. Because he was a bit of a nuisance. I think for Susan, this behavior really started to wear on her. And when he came to her with this idea of flipping houses, she was like, boy, bye. You know?
Mm-hmm.
She was working and supporting them both. So he comes home, she comes home after a long day of work, cooking him dinner. And he's like, hey, I want to take your hard-earned money and gamble with it and do something that I have no idea what I'm doing, you know? And she was like, no.
Yeah.
And it was over for her.
Oh, man.
Well, kind of. You know how relationships can be. It's hard to make a clean break when you've got so much history with someone and they were married, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Though Michael ended up moving back to Indianapolis to be near his brother, he told her, listen, I want to come back. Let's give it one more try. When he came back and tried again, it didn't work. So he went back to Indianapolis. And that's when he took the car. He took their car. But he did leave her something, which was really nice. It was a cassette tape containing 30 minutes of the worst things you could possibly say to someone that you love. He accused her of single-handedly ruining their marriage and just basically ripped her to shreds, trashed her friends and family too while he was at it. And if that wasn't enough of a screw you, he hid notes all over the house for her to find that basically said the same thing.
That's awful.
Yeah. Everyone was really concerned for Susan's safety.
Mm-hmm.
They felt confident that he was gone out of town.
Okay.
But this was really, like, scary. Just his tone in the recordings and the notes. And that's when Cindy's boyfriend came over and nailed all her windows shut. Because she insisted on staying in the house alone. I think she was like, you know, her mom had said, come stay with me. And she's like, no, I'm not going to do that. I need to, you know, keep doing what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And so that's why they nailed her window shut. So once Susan filed for divorce, this was about the time she actually filed for divorce because of all the notes and stuff. Once that happened and some time had passed, things began to shift for her. You know, her friend Cindy said that she was starting to allow herself to have fun again. She'd had a little fling with old JC and Granberry with the hickeys. And she just, they all kind of started to breathe a sigh of relief. Like she was going to be okay. She was going to move on from this chapter. And then just 4 days after Cindy and Roy had seen Susan at a local carnival, her body was found. When Donnie Hensley took on the case and began his investigation, Susan's father, Joe, hounded him nearly every day, just like my dad would, and just like your dad would.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept offering up the only person he could think of in the world that would do this, and that was Michael.
Yeah.
It was obvious to him. It was obvious to everyone in Susan's life. And word was spreading through the town of Stephenville. Now, Michael, now back in Indianapolis, was visited by some local police. And they came by and said, hey, can you come into the station for questioning? And now, you and I would be like, why? What happened?
Yeah.
But he was like, fine. Because this is Michael we're talking about. He was actually having a bit of trouble with a neighbor at the time, so he thought this was related to that. But when they got him in the room and began questioning him, he quickly realized this has nothing to do with this dispute with the neighbor at all. They outright accused him of killing Susan, and he was like, what? Like, he seemed genuinely shocked to hear this news, especially in this way.
Mm-hmm.
He says he vomited. He just couldn't believe that she was dead, and that's how he found out.
Wow.
They pressed and pressed him for a confession, but he quickly lawyered up. Now, Michael's attorney advised him, of course, not to say a word about anything to anyone, even alibis, even alibi witnesses.
Hmm.
He's like, just don't say anything to anyone. When investigators from Texas turned up in Indianapolis to take him back to Texas, he showed them a gun. He pulled up his shirt and showed them the gun sticking in his pants.
Not come with me, sir.
No, Michael had the gun.
Oh, Michael had the gun.
Michael had the gun. Yeah. He showed them the gun and he was like, try me.
Ooh.
I'll shoot you right where you stand. So police really had nothing. They couldn't take Michael back to Texas. They didn't have anything to take him back for. And this really set the tone for law enforcement in Texas and Michael going forward. It was like, whoa, police were, now this was no longer just some guy laying out in the yard with no shirt on.
Mm-hmm.
He's now got a gun and he's threatening the police.
Wow.
So Michael had refused to go to Texas, give his fingerprints, or provide any other biometric information they wanted. But they weren't going to give up on this. They needed to find a way to get those prints.
Right.
And they figured the only way to do it easily would to be to arrest him for something.
Mm-hmm.
And this shouldn't be hard, right? This is Michael we're talking about. So investigators headed back to Indianapolis and watched Michael. They just like sat outside his house watching him. And they remembered that Susan's parents had told them that when he left and took their car, he also took a bunch of Susan's stuff, like a fur coat and some crystal figurines.
Mm-hmm.
So they see him and his brother doing this garage sale. And they're like, okay, if we can get him in possession of some of her stuff,
mm-hmm.
we can just arrest him for like a theft charge. So they get this search warrant. They couldn't see anything like from the car. So they get a search warrant to search the whole house, basically. They didn't find any of Susan's stuff, but they did find some pot in Michael's sister-in-law's purse.
Oh, wow.
So they were like, that'll do.
Yeah.
So they arrested him for that and ended up getting his fingerprints, but they didn't match. They didn't match the ones lifted at the crime scene.
Are you serious?
This had the police completely stunned, and they felt like, well, there has to be some sort of mistake. They probably told the analyst, check again, check again, run the prints again. Well, Donnie Hensley was reassigned to patrol, and years rolled by. So no one was working the case yet again. All the progress they were making was just a waste. And with nothing to go on, the case went cold. Like I said, nobody was working it. Donnie had moved on from the police force, actually, entirely, and went to work for the United Nations.
Mm.
So literally no one was working the case, and that really haunted him. He had nothing to go on. I can imagine for an investigator, it's like someone saying, okay, solve this jigsaw puzzle, and giving them no pieces.
Yeah. I mean, you know how what good I mean? Do you have to be? Like,
right. Like, here are no pieces to the puzzle. Now tell me what it means. Like, tell me what happened. But as years went on, he never forgot about Susan. I mean, he had grown to really care about her and her family. Her family had never changed their mind about who was guilty. And her friends, Cindy and Roy, they ended up getting married, believed it was Michael, and everyone started believing the same thing. Now, Susan's parents sued Michael for an $11,000 life insurance policy that he collected after her death. Michael didn't attend the court proceedings, so the judge sided with her family and awarded them that $11,000 and another $700,000.
Wow.
And ordered Michael to pay that. Of course, they'd never see that money.
Well, yeah.
And actually, it actually, the judgment couldn't be enforced unless Michael re-entered Texas.
Oh.
So, but that was just one more strike against them. And I think for them, it wasn't about the money.
Right.
Just like most civil and like wrongful death cases, it's about a court of law saying you're guilty justice for something.
Yeah.
So you feel like we're getting to the end of the story?
I feel like it, but I know you like to go on some twisty turnies, so.
We're not getting close.
Oh, okay.
Because even more time passed. More years were going by with no answers, and by the early 2000s, a new investigator, Don Miller, was asked to look into a few of the cold cases in the department, including Susan's. Now, Don Miller is not to be confused with Donnie Hensley.
Right.
But they were friends, funnily enough. Don looked over the case and felt like, we got DNA now. Maybe he could get something off those cigarette butts. So he sent those off for analysis. Don contacted Michael Woods and said, listen, you've got to help me out. If you didn't murder your wife, we could clear your name right here and right now. And I think for Michael, he finally felt like someone was motivated to find the truth about who killed Susan and not pin it on him. Right. You know what I mean? Right. Like, the way it was approached with this new investigator was like, hey, let's clear your name.
Yeah.
Not give me your DNA so that I can prove it was you.
Yeah.
And guess what? Michael did submit his DNA. And guess what? Michael's DNA did not match the DNA found on those cigarette butts.
Wow.
With this, Don called up Michael and said, you're clear. You're not the murderer. And Michael broke down. He knew he didn't kill his wife. But to be officially cleared was a weight off of his shoulders that he had been carrying around all of these years.
Yeah.
He may not have been, you know, the most stand-up guy, and he may have been the easy target for this, but he could really move forward now, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't do that before. He actually did volunteer to give his fingerprints and blood samples to the police way back when in Indianapolis. In Indianapolis, not Texas.
Right.
But the Texas police wanted to have full of control over collecting his fingerprints and his DNA because they wanted control over all of that. But he didn't trust the police in Texas. He was like, no, they're going to, you know, twist things around and change my fingerprints or whatever. Yeah. He just did. And he even feared for his life because he was like, I think they'll do anything to pin this murder on me. And he just didn't trust him. So with Michael cleared, they could stop chasing their tails. Because let's be honest, when an investigator or an investigation puts blinders on and they fixate on one person, you're chasing your tail.
Yeah.
Right? So by 2006, just a year after Michael was cleared, Don found out that the Texas Department of Public Safety were able to access the FBI's fingerprint database.
Okay.
There must be some part of him that was super excited, but also like some part of him that was reserved. But they got a match on the fingerprints.
Tell me.
Joseph Scott Hatley? Who's that? His prints ended up in the database because he was arrested in Nevada in 1988 for robbery.
Okay.
His name was never brought up in Susan's file. So who was this guy? Well, Joseph came from a well-to-do, hard-working family in Stephenville, and he had lived there locally his whole life. The family attended church every Sunday. Turns out, he'd also, trigger warning here, raped a 16-year-old girl.
Nope.
But he was never indicted for the charges because a grand jury, for some reason, would not hand down an indictment for him.
Interesting.
Now, in looking more into this reported rape case, which was brutal, Dawn was finding similarities to Susan's murder. The young woman reported that Joseph told her if she didn't comply with him being on top of her and violating her, he would kill her because he'd done it before.
Oh.
Yeah. Now, let's jump to 2021.
Okay.
15 years later, Joseph Hatley dies, not in prison, as you might think, but he was found dead in Abilene in an RV that he'd been living in.
This
isn't the wild part yet. Well, this isn't the only wild part. One of the craziest things for me is that the RV was then sold to a new owner. And this new owner was cleaning the RV when he found hundreds of papers outlining Joseph's life, written by Joseph, just basically like a diary or an autobiography, just neatly written. And as you know, I don't like to glorify a murderer, so I don't want to talk too much about the details contained in his writings. Because, like I said, they were his words, his thoughts. But he did talk about his curiosities about sex and sexual violence that he had that his parents refused to talk with him about.
Okay.
I get that it's no doubt an awkward subject to discuss these types of things with your child. But kids are learning about life. So talk about
them.
this stuff with your kids.
Navigate through it.
Yeah. He had a fixation with pornography at a very young age. And though he attended church with his family, he really didn't believe what he was being taught at church. He just had a lot of questions about the religion. And with all of these elements to him, his family didn't really know about them, other than the, you know, weird sexual stuff that they didn't want to talk about with him. He lived all of these things in silence. Oh, and speaking of family, guess who Joseph was related to?
Who?
Cindy, Susan's best friend.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I wish y'all could see Lena's face just then. Joseph had known Susan and her husband for years. According to Joseph's writings, he believed that Susan had flirted with him the last time he saw her. I highly doubt that. He was also going through a divorce at the time. Susan was going through one. So one night he got really drunk and decided, you know, I'm going to go over to Susan's house right now. Completely uninvited, unannounced. And when he turns up, she was like, oh, hi. Come on in.
Can I help you?
Yeah, she probably said, can I help you? But she invited him in. I mean, she knew him.
Yeah.
She knew him for a very long time, and so she invited him in. And he says after that, everything was a blur. He remembers raping her and severely hurting her. He remembers the struggle, and he knew he couldn't just leave her house like that because she said, I'm going to tell, like, what you've done. And then she got scared and said, no, I won't tell anybody. And so he admits as much in his letters that he had brutalized her.
Wow.
And then he murdered her. He couldn't just leave her. He just couldn't leave like that.
Yeah.
He said he didn't go there intending to kill her. Things just got out of hand. But in the days after Susan was found, of course, he knew of the ongoing investigation because it was all over the local news. Of course, he killed her. Of course, mm-hmm. that's how he knew. Right. But also his cousin was the victim's best friend. So he's hearing all the stuff about, you know, what's going on from her cousin, his cousin. So he went to Susan's funeral. He didn't bat an eyelash. He even signed the guest book at the funeral. Yeah, gross. In his confession, he says he felt no remorse. He even expressed what a shoddy police investigation had taken place. He said that, quote, a basic investigation would have identified me in only a few days, end quote.
Right.
And you know what, Joseph? I happen to agree with you there.
Yeah. Oh my
God. Joseph was never interviewed. Never interviewed. His name wasn't anywhere in the file as being relevant to Susan in any way, shape, or form. Yeah. I mean, she was... her best friend was Cindy, and he was her cousin. You know what I mean? And they hung out, what he referred to in his rambling as the round table. Mm. Like, they would just hang out, you know, play cards, whatever, all the time. Now, this coupled with the police not prosecuting him for the rape case, I mean, he must have felt invincible.
Mm-hmm.
Just murdered someone, got away with it. Raped someone, got away with it. So he ended up moving to Nashville after Susan's murder, got married, had children, as they do.
Gosh.
And all while working as a long-haul truck driver, he was going around the country continuing to violate women.
Wow. Shocker.
And you might be asking yourself, how the crap did this guy die in an RV at aged 56?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he died of cancer, but not in prison. Right. Why wasn't he in prison? Because when they came to arrest him in 2006, with all the evidence stacked against him, the fingerprints and the cigarette butts that eventually did match that DNA, he cut a deal.
Oh.
30 years in prison. 30 okay. years. I see you trying to do the math over there. Well, in 2017, he was diagnosed with cancer. And just 11 years into his prison sentence, poor guy, he's got cancer. Let's let him out. He was released on good behavior.
Are you... What?
Do you have any words, Lena?
None.
Can you find any?
No.
I know. Now, one thing that stands out to me about this case is the fingerprints were the thing that nailed him, not DNA. I primarily used the Texas Monthly report that your mom sent us in this case,
mm-hmm.
but I did reference some other sources about the story, and some of them sort of spun this case as a DNA case. And while they did match his DNA to the cigarette butts after the fact, mm-hmm. it was the fingerprints that got him caught. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We all love a DNA case, okay? Believe me. It's the wave of the future when it comes to solving these cold cases. But this time, it was the fingerprints. Good old-fashioned fingerprints. Now, I've said it before, and I have to say it again. If you have murdered someone, and you've not yet been caught... careful, my guy. Our technology is getting better and better and better by the day, and we will come for you one of these days. Wouldn't you rather be the one to make peace with your family and friends than have the police show up and put handcuffs on you in front of your children, your grandchildren? You know?
Well, I mean, that would mean you'd have to filter in your thoughts and filter and have self-control, but...
Exactly. Okay, let's say you die and you never have to spend one day in jail. We still will figure out that you killed somebody. And the people that have invested their time in you will live the rest of their lives in complete confusion. Like,
oh my gosh.
Can you believe dad did that? Granddad did that?
Oh,
Mom did that?
That's so
Don't
sad.
Don't you want to make things right for them at least? You know, just look at the guy the other day who was arrested, who's allegedly the Long Island serial killer. Did you see that?
Yeah, I did.
He was an architect, a father, a husband. He's all wearing suits.
Yeah.
And he allegedly, his DNA was found on a pizza box. Maybe I'll do that case at some point, but I think it's been done on a lot of podcasts, so maybe not. But
yeah,
I think I might be wasting my breath here, because if you have killed another person and can just carry on with the rest of your life, that's monstrous. Like, and they likely care about no one else, even mm-hmm. even their offspring, even the you know, the women they marry and the people they bring into this world after the fact, the children, the grandchildren, you know.
Yeah,
it's
to be
it's
able just, to compartmentalize
right
a whole nother
that's it Lena that's the exact it's compartmentalization. They are putting that person, their monster, in a box under the bed.
Absolutely.
And they're living out their life like, oh, honey, can I make you a cup of coffee this morning? Oh, great job at your game, little Timmy. You know, you did awesome at your baseball game. And it's like, you're someone somewhere is sitting on a bleacher next to a murderer, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, that gives me chills.
So Cindy didn't have any contact with him after he moved away, or like...
She did. But they didn't, you know, so it wasn't until 2006 when he was connected to her murder. So
right, but I'm just wondering if, like, all this time, if she had contact with him, like, did she notice, was there any...
Never.
Now that she knows this, like, can she look back and say, oh, he said this one thing, and that makes a lot of sense now, you know?
You know, it's funny you mention that. It wasn't her who said, looking back.
Okay.
Roy, her husband, actually said, you know, when I first met Joseph, Cindy wanted me to, like, you know, I don't know, bond with him because we were both readers. And so he was like, I quickly learned that the only books he wanted to read were really dark books. Like, he wouldn't have liked me. True crime books. Things about murder. Things about just really dark subject matter.
Yeah.
And so Roy really never got very close to him, but the rest of his family said, you know, he had like, you know, typical boy anger things, but it really they couldn't see that crossing into violent behavior.
Gotcha.
And so she actually, after he was tied to the crime, they didn't believe it for a while. Until, you know, of course, then the DNA matched and then everything. And then, of course, many years later, with his confession and everything like that, they've made peace with it. But, yeah, it's funny. I think his family knew him to be a bit of a, you know, different kind of a kid. But we have a lot of different kind of people in our family, you know?
We do.
And we don't hold that against them.
Right.
It's just like, oh, that's just how he is.
Yeah.
Oh, he's got those quirks. And, oh, yeah, I saw him lose his crap one time, and that's okay. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So when you're dealing with family, I think people tend to...
give a little grace.
Exactly. A lot of grace.
Yeah.
A lot of grace. But that's all I have for you for this case. It's wild that it took so long.
But they got him. And that's...
they could have got him on the third day. That's the thing, though. is Joseph is right. They could have solved this a long time ago.
Yeah, and the fact that he's just sitting there kind of just, like, laughing. Maybe not even laughing, but, like, it's like, these guys.
No, he was laughing, pretty much. He was like, wow, y'all suck at your job.
I'm impressed that he wrote it all down. Like, yeah. He just had to get it out of his mind or his brain. I don't know. To just knowing that if he died, people were going to come in and find his belongings.
Yeah.
Written, you know, all these pages of stuff written down. That's, he had cancer. He knew he was dying. He knew he would leave it there and somebody would find it, right?
Right. Yeah. That's the weird thing. I heard someone say that deathbed confessions are to be believed. Like, never underestimate a deathbed confession. That person is going to die. They have absolutely nothing to lose at this point.
True. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I heard that said in another case, and I was like, that's really powerful, if you think about it, that he left that behind. He was like, I've got nothing else to lose at this point. And he even detailed about how he would rape women on the road, and as he was working as a trucker, he just, and nothing was ever reported. Nothing was ever tied to him.
Oh my gosh.
You know, half the women he took advantage of were down on their luck or drug addicts or, you know, sex workers. And, you know, they are not inclined to report things like that because they're worried about getting in trouble themselves.
True.
So just, you know, shake my head.
Well, thank you for doing this case. Very interesting. Rest
in peace,
Susan.
Thanks for sending it along, Aunt Karen.
All right. Well, this was great. Let's do it again sometime.
Let's do it. See you next time, guys.
Bye.
Bye now.
Well, thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. If you're enjoying our podcast, please leave us a 5-star rating so that other true crime fans can find us.
If you have any case suggestions or just want to say hey, email us at cousinsoncrime@gmail.com. And be sure to follow us on Instagram, where we post case photos and information at Cousins on Crime Podcast.